Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I'm your host for the full 2 hours this weekend. That's right. Big Al is taking a little break from KER politics, so that means you are going to get 2 hours of metals and markets commentary. The first hour is going to be focused more on the metal sector, along with a update from Novo Resources to wrap up the first hour, and the second hour more focused on general markets, as well as I know I'm going to be getting a lot of comments on the Fed and what came out of that press conference and statement midway through last week. Happy to say that I am kicking off this show with Rick Rule. Everybody knows Rick Rule, but more importantly, you know what? He comes over from Sprott, who has been very active in the resource sector over these last couple years. One of the few groups that has been injecting, I think, key portions of money into stocks. Let's first take a look from the high level at the precious metals, gold more specifically, and it's set up in 2019. We are in a bit of an uptrend, but quite frankly, that middle to tail end of the year last year was rough on gold until it managed to bottom in October. Where do you think the precious metals stand right now in your eyes here, Rick?
My own suspicion is that we are in for a good, but perhaps not great, 2019 from a gold pricing standpoint. I think we're in the early parts of a rollover of the U.S. dollar. I think the fact that the Fed has decided that they're going to be patient, which is a buzzword for soft, means that the strength that the dollar has enjoyed relative to some other currencies, and specifically with regards to gold, probably begins to roll over in 2019, which is good for gold. You've heard me say on your show for years that the gold price is importantly a manifestation of people's faith in the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar. In other words, they trade conversely. If the yield on the U.S. 10-year treasuries doesn't actively reflect people's suspicion with regards to the purchasing power, that is, the depreciation of their purchasing power, then the treasury falls and gold does well. And I think we're in the very beginnings of that move right now. The levels of debt we have, which don't seem to bother people anymore, still bother people who can do arithmetic. The idea that at the federal level we owe $22 trillion in recourse obligations and $130 or $140 trillion in non-recourse obligations, over time, that number begins to weigh on people's faith in the ability of the U.S. dollar to maintain its purchasing power. And as that wavering of faith gains strength, the gold price will gain strength too.
So this year, it sounds like more of a development on the positive side for the precious metals as more things start to go in their favor. But again, kind of what you said there is don't necessarily expect a screaming higher gold price, just more of this building to better data. What do you have to say about some of that recent information coming out of other central banks that they have started buying gold? I know a lot of the gold bugs hang on to this kind of data and say this is really going to pop the gold price. I think it's more about the generalist investor finally showing some interest. How do you balance the two?
I agree with you completely. My friend Doug Casey once described central bankers as people who might have trouble finding jobs at convenience stores had they not been born into good families and worn good suits. The idea that they're particularly savvy investors, I think, has been disproven fairly conclusively over time. The sales by the Canadian and British central banks of gold early in the last decade before it rose sixfold in price being prime examples. I'm more impressed, frankly, by private sector investors who have had very good track records over the last 30 years, the sort of Ray Dalios of the world, and their buying of gold. And their buying of gold for the right reason, not because they're expecting immediate speculative gains, but rather because gold seems to them like a store of value in a very uncertain time. I take some heart in extremely smart people who have made billions of dollars with their own efforts rather than the sort of blatherings of central bankers whose job it is to serve a sort of a homogenous and not so smart electorate.
A lot of these central bankers seem to deal with a lot of this groupthink, and they all seem to read off of similar playbooks, which seems to get them in the problems that they're in right now. But Rick, what about this overall trend of everybody getting very pessimistic in terms of the markets? We have seen we are in bear markets in markets around the world, and even many of the major markets in the U.S. dropped that 20% plus level just at the tail end of last year. How concerned do precious metals investors need to be of a major pullback in global equity markets also dragging down the precious metals?
I think that precious metals and precious metals equities investors need to be concerned from two different points of view. In particular, and I'm not saying it's going to happen, but we need to be concerned about a liquidity event, about a black swan, some unforeseen circumstance coming into a market where people were already afraid, a situation analogous to 2008. When you have liquidity-driven events, tertiary assets, which is to say small stocks and precious metals, get sold off very, very hard. We need to remember that gold stocks are stocks. And when you have an overall decline in the stock market, the gold stocks fall too. Now, they sometimes come back more quickly as a consequence of their underpinnings with regards to value. But gold stocks are stocks. The second thing that you and I need to recognize is that the audience listening to this, while they respond to gold, are normally broader-based natural resource investors. People who are gold investors are often intrigued by a variety of sort of hard money or natural resource topics. And the circumstance that would seem to be causing the major equity markets to sell off have to do with the fear that after 9 years of relatively benign economic climate, that is a recovery, however tepid, that recovery is long of tooth. And if we dip into recession on a global basis, particularly if we were to dip into recession in the United States, that would impact demand for a wide variety of commodities and, of course, impact pricing on commodities equities. So I think we need to be nervous both from a general market liquidity point of view and also from a broader economic point of view as resource investors and as investors in general.
And that's a whole nother reason for always having some sort of cash, being able to take advantage of any big drops in these stocks rather than being fully invested, especially in still an environment where there are a lot of question marks and nothing is perfect or for sure for a precious metals rise. Can we get just a quick comment from you before we get into some of the nuances within the actual stocks on some of the other resource sectors? Base metals continue to struggle. That can be a lot because of global growth. Energy metals really came off the burn last year. Do you see any of these starting to capture some more attention?
We see in the subsectors uranium definitely catching a bid, definitely catching interest. The base metals stocks have been really, really, really hurt. It appears that there are definitely supply deficits and supply deficits mounting, but people are concerned about the economy and about demand for various base metals looking 2 to 3 years out. It's a really interesting conundrum to me in base metals. You have major base metals, copper, zinc, I would argue, nickel, that are all priced in global markets below the incentive prices necessary to bring new mines into production. So we are living as a society on resources that come from mines that are very long of tooth, discovered 40 years ago, put into production 25 years ago. So at some point in time, and I can't tell you when, my suspicion is that we begin to have a series of rolling supply stocks, which will benefit base metals. But could that time be 2 years from now or 3 years from now or 4 years from now? An eternity for young or younger micro-cap stock speculators is the open question. From my point of view, I've always found my own portfolio to benefit from buying very high-quality mineral deposits, irrespective of market. You know, if you look back at the lessons we learned over the last 10 years, which were, of course, extraordinarily harsh, while that happened, great deposits, which are rare, but I'm thinking now of Timok with reservoir minerals, in a market that declined by probably 90%, I'm talking about the overall junior resource index, reservoir, of course, went from 45 cents to a $7 or $8 takeover by Nevsun, which was itself subsequently taken over. So one message I would leave people with is really irrespective of your outlook in the near term for metals markets, concentrate your efforts when they're available on very, very, very good deposits. And then let time work for you as opposed to working against you.
That's a very good comment, and in all fairness, that's been something that's been working even in these slow metals markets, is being extraordinarily selective in terms of the stocks that you invest in. Can I get your comment on how generally stocks, metal stocks, have been lagging even, let's say, the gold price? We're still seeing maybe too many stocks in general in the gold sector, and just a lack of capital flowing into a wide range of these stocks. How do you balance out a rising gold price and stock prices that are still at some pretty depressed levels?
That's a wonderful question. And I think partially it reflects skepticism on the part of the investment community, both the generalist community and the specialist community, about the structure of the gold mining industry. You put your finger on one criticism, which is to say that there are too many mining companies, majors, intermediates, juniors, and explorers. And that is being helped by the recent trend to mergers and acquisition. But the truth is that the industry spends too much money on listing costs and general and administrative costs. And the investors are wise to this. The investors are looking at the index and how much money goes out in G&A and how little money goes in the ground. And some of them are saying, wisely, I think, if you think the gold price is going to go up, buy gold, buy the gold stocks later. The second reason for this malaise in gold equities relative to the gold price, I think, has to do with the experience of the last decade. And that's very damning for the gold industry. The gold price in the period 2000 to 2010, that decade, went from about $260 an ounce to $1,500 an ounce. And cash flow per share among the gold producers fell. Now, that took special skill to use a circumstance where the commodity that you produced increased sixfold in price while delivering a decrease in cash flow per share. And I think the industry is going to have to show investors that they aren't going to repeat those mistakes. I have some faith that they won't repeat those mistakes unless they're given the opportunity to. So in that regard, the malaise, the softness in the gold equities relative to the gold price is probably in the longer term useful, because it will temper the enthusiasm of management teams to do stupid things with money.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And unfortunately, and it is so unfortunate that even through this bear market, so many people have talked about the need for companies to be run more efficiently and more effectively. And now we're still seeing them make the same errors they were making 8 to 10 years ago. Let's look a little bit on the bright side, though, in terms of some of the M&A activity that has happened more at the top end, some of these majors, and especially just recently with Newmont and Goldcorp, and there's been a number of majors combining forces. Where do you see the opportunity coming here? Do you think that's going to lead to more acquisitions of the smaller companies, or is there another area where you see other companies being able to take advantage of some of the gap that's left?
I see three circumstances, all good. The first is that the lateral mergers by large companies gives them the ability to manage more assets with lower general and administrative head, with lower general and administrative expense. In other words, cutting G&A out of these businesses. Newmont has suggested that there could be as much as $100 million in savings. I suspect that there could be $250 million in savings, which would be good. The second thing is that we've proven over time that larger, more liquid companies enjoy higher share prices and lower cost of capital. And in a capital-intensive business like mining, that's a great competitive advantage. So one of the things that will happen, I think, is that it is as you have fewer entities among the larger companies, that the share prices generally, represented probably by the XAU, will go up over 12 months for no other reason than more participants are larger and more liquid. There will also, I think, be a reasonable number of peer-to-peer mergers rather than takeovers, as institutional investors see the savings that they enjoyed in the majors and ask other parts of their portfolio to deliver them similar benefits. What I think will happen in the near term that investors won't like as much is that the takeovers that all of us suggested would happen in 2019, where larger companies took over smaller companies, will be less prevalent. The truth is that as a consequence of the Newmont and Barrick mergers, and to a lesser degree, the acquisition of Tahoe by Pan American, there's going to be $10 or $12 or $13 billion worth of assets for sale in the next 12 months, which I think will capture a lot of the cash that would otherwise have gone into takeovers. One area that really interests me, I guess two areas that interest me. The first is that the providers of capital to the industry, the people who will have to find the $12 billion for the acquirers, should do very well. That's a particularly happy event for me at Sprott because that's one of the businesses that we're in. And I suspect that the provision of capital, as an example, bridge lending for merger and acquisition activity in 2019 will be very good. I think the other beneficiaries of this that come immediately to mind will be the royalty and streaming companies, the Franco-Nevadas, the Wheaton Precious, the Anglo-Pacifics, the Sandstorms, the Royal Golds. People have been wondering if those companies could continue to grow their asset bases and deploy capital as rapidly as they have done in the past. And I think this year will be an absolute banner year for them deploying capital in these M&A activities. And the consequence of that deployment is that analysts and investors will be able to model out revenue growth on a per share basis for these companies over the next 5 or 6 years. So I think one of the immediate beneficiaries of this will be the royalty and streaming companies, which are already good businesses and have suffered some share price declines in 2018, making them more attractive investment targets anyway. The second circumstance that I think occurs for investors out of these dispositions will be the fact that more assets and more management teams are available. And I think what you'll see is some of the better juniors being able to acquire assets from these dispositions that they are able to focus on and also round out their human resources team from high-quality people who were able to make less of an impact at Barrick or at Newmont or at Randgold, or at Goldcorp, than they will be in the juniors. I remember some years ago when Barrick took over Placer Dome, the amount of intellectual capital that was dropped down into the junior sector positively impacted the junior sector, particularly in Vancouver, for 2 or 3 years. In our particular case at Sprott, we were able to hire Andy Jackson and Dr. Neil Adshead, who made an immediate difference in the performance of Sprott for its shareholders and for its investors. And I would expect this infusion of intellectual capital to make a real difference in the junior market over the next 2 or 3 years.
All right, Rick, some very interesting comments and some, I think, good focus for investors to look at the opportunities that are going to be present after these mergers and acquisitions are all completed and some of these people and properties start to get offloaded. Rick, it's great having you on the show. I greatly appreciate all of the time that you spend with us, and hey, I greatly appreciate all of your comments. I hope you have a great weekend, and thanks again for your time.
Certainly a pleasure, Corey. Thank you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.